I'm Gareth Mitchell, and this is the BBC World Service, where I have technology for you. Today, the satellites that will image the Earth's surface on unprecedented detail. What's more, they'll do the whole job every 5 days. They're predicting and charting the effects of climate change on natural disasters, and the high-resolution imagery will be made available to all of us for free. I spoke to the mission's chief just before the first of the two spacecraft launched earlier this week, and we'll tell you all about it on Click.
BBC News with David Austin. A Hungarian government is temporarily suspending a key European Union asylum agreement. It compels the country to take back asylum seekers who had first entered Hungary but subsequently travelled on to other EU member states. A spokesman said the government had made the decision as Hungary was overburdened by illegal immigration. The European Commission has asked Hungary to explain its move. Lawmakers in South Carolina have voted to go ahead with a debate on whether to remove the Confederate flag from the grounds of the state capital in Columbia. The move is a response to the killing of 9 African Americans in Charleston last week. Pictures of the white suspect brandishing the flag have emerged online. 2 new cases of Ebola have been confirmed in the capital of Sierra Leone. Freetown has been clear of the disease for several weeks. There are fears of further infection as the new cases occurred in a densely populated slum. The north of Sierra Leone continues to be affected by Ebola. Kurdish fighters in northern Syria say they've taken the town of Ain Issa from the militant group Islamic State. It's just 50 kilometers from the jihadist stronghold of Raqqa. A young female suicide bomber is reported to have killed at least 10 people in the town of Bujba in northeastern Nigeria. One eyewitness said the bomber could not have been more than 12 years old. Earlier this year, the Nigerian military seized Bujba from the jihadist group Boko Haram. Authorities in Mexico say they've arrested the son of one of the country's most wanted drug lords. Ruben Oseguera Gonzalez is believed to be the second in command of the Jalisco New Generation cartel, the criminal organization led by his father. The World Bank has announced it's providing up to $500 million to finance reconstruction in Nepal after the deadly earthquakes there in April. Much is to be allocated to rebuild homes in rural areas. And that's the latest BBC News.
Hello again, everyone. I'm Gareth Mitchell, and welcome along to Click. Today, the high-resolution imaging satellite that's launched. A writer is here who's been telling the story of Bitcoin. Virtual money of a different kind boosts financial literacy in a New Zealand classroom. And a Russian programmer transforms 2D into 3D. How about that? Well, Bill Thompson is here as well for some comments as well. Hello, Bill.
Hello, Eric. And as ever, I love satellite stories. So looking forward to that one.
Oh, yes. This one goes out to you, Mr. Bill Thompson. Mm. And indeed, it is quite a tall order, isn't it? To image the surface of the Earth at an almost unprecedented resolution. In fact, as good as 10 metres, that's quite a resolution. And not only that, but to do that, all that imaging, the Earth's work is to do it every 5 days. You would need quite a satellite to achieve that. In fact, you need 2. And so it is that Europe has just launched the first of 2 optical satellites that will image features like agriculture, pollution, inland and coastal waters, and all to help predict and plan for the effects of climate change on natural disasters. Sentinel 2A is the one that's just launched, and that was first thing on Tuesday morning. The second spacecraft goes up next year. I've been hearing more from Joseph Aschbacher, and he's head of the Copernicus Space Office.
Sentinel 2, which has been launched last night, is in fact the second satellite in the row of Copernicus satellites. The first one was launched last year. Last year's launch was on our satellite, which is taking images day and night of the whole globe. This one, Sentinel 2, is an optics satellite, which takes images in the visible and the infrared spectrum of the electromagnetic radiation, the sunlight, which is being reflected as we see with our eyes, but also going into the near infrared, which is not visible to our eyes, because there we get information about the state of vegetation, but also we can distinguish snow, ice, or clouds, for example. So it really is an optics satellite, which is used for a number of applications, most of them are dealing with monitoring over land, and to really give a more complete picture of the Earth.
What kind of resolution will be possible from the spacecraft?
Sentinel-2 has a resolution of 10 meters, about 4 channels. There are other channels at 20 meters and at 60 meters.
So we already have had the US Landsat, the French Spot Observatory as well.
So what benefits will come from the launch of the Sentinel-2 spacecraft?
There'll be two satellites which are being in orbit at the same time. One has been launched yesterday, the other one will be launched in about a year and a half. With these two satellites, we get global coverage, the whole globe, every 5 days at the equator, and every 2 to 3 days in mid-latitude.
So we are a few months away now from the launch, well, over a year away from the launch of the second of the Sentinel satellites. What will then happen once both of them are in orbit?
One satellite has a repeat cycle globally of 10 days, and with two satellites you get a repeat cycle of the whole coverage of the Earth every 5 days. For example, for agricultural monitoring, if you want to determine yields or determine crop types, you do need frequent coverage and frequent observations of agricultural crops along its growing cycle. And with 5 days repeat cycle, this really is an optimum information source for this kind of observations.
What benefits will the wider public, as it were, within Europe and maybe beyond, get from these? What is going to happen with this data?
This data will be provided for free to everyone. We have been discussing a lot with various stakeholders, and we have adopted a completely free and open data policy. Really, everyone can retrieve this data from the internet. Then you can download as many images as you want of any part of the world you wish to see. So we expect a whole series of new applications to develop. Commercial applications and applications that are for the public good, related to climate, related to the state of the environment, but also information that is very critical, for example, for the world population. In 2050, we expect to have 9 billion people on this planet. These 9 billion people, of course, are migrating towards urban areas and coastal areas. For example, today, about 50% of the people are living in larger cities. This will be 70% by 2050. The same applies to the coastal region. This will have huge impacts on the Earth as a whole. We always talk about climate change, and we all know the effect of mankind changing our living environment. And the Sentinel-2, but also the other Sentinels, will be a prime information source to monitor the state of our Earth, and in order to make really better decisions by politicians, by the people. This information is crucial because many of the information and the parameters we do not yet fully understand and do not yet fully know. Sentinel-2 really contributes to better understanding the state of the Earth, and therefore really help us preserving our planet and providing better information to those who make the decisions on how to manage our planet as a whole.
Joseph Aschbacher, and Bill Thompson was listening to that, and one thing that really struck me just listening to that interview playing out is the sheer amount of data that will be created by these satellites that are going to image the entire surface every 5 days. That's incredible.
It is, and, you know, and it's going to be stored and processed and made available for people like us to use, but, you know, for farmers and research workers and scientists around the world. It really is, you know, it's a very exciting project. And you know, exactly, the whole of the Copernicus program is really exciting, that the European Union as a whole has realized we need to keep an eye on the Earth, we need to monitor the Earth's health. And so a whole range of programs, not just satellite but ground-based systems, are being deployed and things are being put up there to allow us to do that in a much more sort of immediate way.
What about the mission itself? I know it's an optical mission. It's, you know, these are the images that it's gathering. I assume they wouldn't launch it otherwise, but do you think this is data that we need, this kind of data?
I think we need as much data as we can get at the moment. You know, the evidence for climate change is, you know, sort of irresistible. We know things are shifting in the planet's biosphere. We know that things are moving around. What we need are recordings. We need to know how things are moving, you know, day by day, week by week, year by year. And gathering information across the whole range of spectra is important. So the infrared and ultraviolet is vital. We need to keep doing that as well. But the visible spectrum is also useful, I think, in many ways. For me, it's going to be interesting to see what uses are made of this material that haven't been anticipated. But if it is being published as open data, then the interesting stuff will happen when a bunch of people get their hands on the data sets and start using it in ways that the people who watch the satellite didn't imagine.
Indeed, great. Bill, thank you very much indeed for that. Well, now, I never wanted that to happen. I wish I could go back and convince myself to take a different path. Those were the words a few weeks ago of Ross Ulbricht, the founder of the illicit online drug marketplace, Silk Road as he was sentenced to a life prison sentence. Going down with Albrecht, though, was the reputation, the fun of Bitcoin, the cryptocurrency that underpinned much of the trading on the Silk Road. But whatever the detractors say, Bitcoin does seem to go from strength to strength, a decentralized currency that's proving as disruptive to banking as online phenomena like Wikipedia, eBay, and Google have been to the establishment in media, retail, trading, and advertising. So Bitcoin is quite a story, so somebody inevitably at some point was going to have a go at writing it all down and putting it into a book. And indeed, that person is New York Times journalist Nathaniel Popper, who's just released the book Digital Gold, The Untold Story of Bitcoin, and he's in the studio now. So let's go back a little bit from your book. So this is really the history of cryptocurrencies. Where did it all begin?
Yeah, well, Bitcoin itself was launched in late 2008, early 2009, but this is a story that really goes back to the 1980s and 1990s, and a group of privacy activists, many of them out in California, who referred to themselves as the cypherpunks. And these were folks who realized that as the kind of information age progressed, privacy was going to be the central issue, because information about yourself was going to be something that there was going to be a matter of who had control that. Was it going to be the government, or was it going to be you or corporations? And at the very center of that cypherpunk project from the beginning was money, because money tells you so much about your identity, where you are. And so they began this project of trying to create digital cash, an anonymous form of transacting. And that project is really what led in 2008-2009 to Bitcoin.
And of course, one thing we learned very quickly from the book is what Bitcoin is, and the whole idea of it being a decentralized currency. It's kind of simple, but also incredibly complicated to describe Bitcoin. How would you just sum it up for our listeners who still may not be entirely sure what it is and how it works?
Well, I think one thing that is important to understand, and that's perhaps a little less intimidating, is that it actually is many different things, and that's why it's complicated to sum it up. But it was, at the base, I think, an effort to create digital cash, something that would allow you to have a transaction in cyberspace directly with somebody. You wouldn't need a third party to send value through the internet without relying on a bank or any sort of third party authority. And so I think that's where it begins. You have a whole network underneath it that makes that possible, and that network and the database is a lot of what people are playing with nowadays. But if you start just from thinking about it as this concept of being able to send money over the internet, like email allows you to send a message over the internet, you don't have to go through anybody. Nobody has to have to do that. You just give the money directly to somebody else. And that's, in essence, I think, what Bitcoin makes possible.
And as we go through the book, you visit many of, both physically and also in your prose, you visit many of those who brought Bitcoin together. And Bill Thompson, for me, one thing that really did come across is that it really has been a community thing. You know, so many different people have written so many different pieces of code and contributed in so many different ways to make it happen.
Yeah, I think Nathaniel's done a very good job of turning what could be quite dry technical stuff into, if you like, a rollicking good read. The people involved are, some of them are quite strange, and they're very ambitious, some of them are quite socially isolated. So all of that comes over very strongly. And although I knew the story of Bitcoin quite well from reading the papers and, you know, what was online and stuff like that, I hadn't put it together into the narrative that the book gives. And it gave me a much stronger understanding, particularly of the libertarian political roots of the movement, things like that, which were otherwise mentioned but only in passing. I thought it was fascinating how few women are involved. I think there's one named woman in the book, Nathaniel, and that's the girlfriend of one of the programmers.
Yeah, it's not for lack of trying. It's like so much of technology, it was dominated by men. And what's interesting is in those early days, this wasn't an in-person thing. You could hide behind your screen name, and yet still everybody involved were men. And I think as it developed, you're right, what you caught on to was the fact that this wasn't just technology. To me, it was a social movement. It was about getting people together around this idea. And that was what made me want to write this book. I see that this strange technology, this strange sort of obscure financial technology, could make people so excited that they were willing to join this movement. Those are some of the elements that I think don't come across in a lot of the reporting, where you just sort of see Is the price up? Is it down? And should this be valuable? Should it not be valuable? This really, to me, the story sort of speaks to our time and why people cared about this so much.
And it fascinated me just how much the regulators started to engage with that. You really brought through that sense that the big banks, the financial regulators in New York and China, were taking interest in this and trying to deal with this as a movement.
And yet, whilst, you know, there's been a lot of kerfuffle amongst regulators, doesn't the fact remain that it is all overhyped? So I think I read there are only about 60,000 transactions a day on Bitcoin.
The way I like to put it is, Bitcoin is still entirely speculative. People are speculating on what this is going to be. It is not the thing that it promises it will be. It hasn't decentralized or disintermediated the banks or central banks. But everybody is still gambling on what it's going to be in the future. And what's interesting is you get higher and higher level people who are getting involved and who are willing to make that bet. And you have Goldman Sachs now, you have New York Stock Exchange, saying this actually, there is something new in here. There's some kernel here that is going to lead to something new. We just don't know what it is yet. And that's what you're getting at, that people, this is not a day-to-day thing really anywhere in the world.
Okay, well, we're going to leave it there. Nathaniel Pepper, thanks very much for tuning in. This is a clip from the BBC in London, and I'm Gareth Mitchell, and we're going to talk about a virtual economy, a virtual currency even, of a different kind now, as we head over to New Zealand, where there's a classroom being transformed effectively into a virtual economy. It's all about teaching financial literacy, and it's a platform called Banker, and that's part of the Q, by the way. Our reporter, Simon Morton, has been to see Banker in action at the school, which is in Wellington, as I say, in New Zealand.
It's like money in the car.
And with no interest, then we have to pay cash.
And who pays you interest?
The teacher.
If he leaves something like a lunchbox or a pencil or a jacket lying on the floor, and this person picks it up, and we have to pay $10,000 to get it out again.
Kendall Flutie is the co-founder of Banker.co.
I went home in Christchurch last year. I've got a brother that's a lot younger than me. He was in Form 2, year 8 at the time. Usually when I go home and talk to him about football, he loves football, girls a little bit, so he'll talk about girls. But this time he was throwing me curveballs. He was saying, should I hire someone as a contractor or an employee? And I was just like, where are these questions coming from? This is a desire. So I drilled down and it turned out his teacher was running a really cool financial literacy campaign in their classroom. And he'd been running it all year and it was quite complex. So I had to talk to his teacher about it. I was just really curious. And it sounded great. What he was doing was fantastic. He had essentially a mock banking system in the class. They could swipe coupons, they earned interest and tax, but I thought it was pretty inefficient as what my developer had on. And there's a lot of things he was doing manually which could be automated and save a lot of his time. So that's really where the idea came from.
My name's Jack, I'm 9. I'm 10.
I'm Imogen and I'm nearly 11.
I'm Becky and I'm 11.
I'm Nathan and I'm 10.
And you're Jolene, the teacher.
Yes, Jolene Buckman, a youth teacher at a high school.
The financial literacy curriculum came out in about 2007 and I wanted to be able to include it in my class program through what we were already doing and not teach it separately. So we set up a class currency system.
And what is a class currency system? Can you explain that to me?
It's like money, but it's fake money. It's in the class. Well, it's where we can earn money from our jobs we do.
I would earn interest and have to pay tax.
What's interest?
We'll get money on how much money we have in our bank account.
And who pays you interest?
The teacher.
So the overarching goal here is to improve financial literacy. That's quite a big ambition. So I think you can break that down into things like, you know, when you come out of school, being able to manage your personal finances or understanding that you shouldn't take on financial debt.
We're learning about how interest rates can change depending on how much money people are earning.
And so today, Banker, when I've had a look at it, is essentially a pretty graphical spreadsheet, isn't it? Is that a good way to describe it?
Pretty simple. We also try and relate it to mock online banking. We try and make it really fun, intuitive, and attractive for the kids to interact with as well.
we have a TV in the classroom that the computer hooked up to, and they can see who I'm making payments out to, and then it becomes their responsibility to log in to the account themselves and see that that money has gone in. Then they can choose to transfer it to their savings account where they get interest, or keep it in their current account where they, if they get fined or things happen in the classroom where they have to pay money back out to me, they're able to do that with the money that they've just earned.
If we leave something like a lunchbox or a pencil or a jacket lying on the floor in the cloak bay or something, and this person picks it up and she takes it and puts it in things to buy back, and we have to pay like $10,000 to get it out again.
So what's your favourite part of the whole sort of financial literacy?
Obviously making money. You probably like making money, do you?
Yeah, probably through interest I get most of mine through.
And what is tax? Does anyone want to have a go at describing what tax is? Oh, look, they're all putting their hands up.
Well, it means how much money we earn, we have to pay tax on it. So if I earn $100,000, I might have to pay 25%.
And where does that money go, that 25%? Do you have any idea?
It goes to Miss Batson, but I'm not sure what she does with it. It goes to the government to help pay for hospitals and schools and stuff.
And it also goes to new roads and to help the community.
So what's the most important thing you've learned about money management from your perspective?
You should save and you can buy things.
I think about trying to not get fined because I don't really want to pay that much money back because it's really expensive.
So no tax evasion there. That report was from Simon Morton. Remember my manners in class. I say thank you to Miss Butson and the pupils at Churton Park School. And of course you heard there from Kendall Flutie. So, Bill, what do you make of all that?
Well, the app says it's fake money but real money. And it was quite clear hearing the children there talking to Simon that, you know, they are beginning to grapple with some of the real issues about financial literacy. So it is having some impact. And financial literacy is becoming important in school curriculums around the world. It clearly matters so much that deploying technology like this to help young people figure out how to manage their money when they go into adulthood has to be important.
Yeah, I'm talking back to my own economics lessons at school, and our teacher, Mr. Bengry, actually got us to buy some imaginary shares, you know, on the real FTSE 100, on our share index here in the UK, and it was just a really useful way of learning about how markets work and equities and so on.
I did the same thing. We had an exercise where over 2 weeks we managed a company, but it was all done using, shall we say, a clunky computer, shall you say, and, you know, and it was a very difficult exercise to really understand. The thing about the app-based system we've seen with Banker is that the kids are actually seeing the real thing. It looks more like the systems they will encounter when they do leave school and have online banking and things like that. And it's that power of simulation and of multi-user simulation that the latest technology brings to things like this that I think is going to have the real impact going forward.
Great. I knew we could bank on you for a good comment there, Bill Thompson. Thank you for that. Well, finally, in St. Petersburg, the veteran art professor constructs his abstract surrealist designs, as he has done for years. His eyes closed, he conveys ideas from the depths of his subconscious as he forms lines and complex shapes on the art room wall. Meanwhile, the 16-year-old computer whiz is a draftsman of a different sort. Coding is his craft, so will the older man pass on his artistic ideas to the younger man? The scene then shifts to Venice on the Dorsoduro side of the Giudecca Canal, and the relationship between the generations becomes clearer. Ivan Gorbakov of the St. Petersburg Academy of Arts traces out his shapes. Daniel Franz deploys his machine vision system to pick up these two-dimensional abstractions and then reinterpret them in 3D. A translucent sphere appears on the screen with indents and distortions. And just as decades mark out the time between the older and the younger generations, hours pass as the sphere is gradually fabricated layer by layer on a 3D printer. Bill and I watched it all happen, and then we spoke to the older man and a stand-in for the younger.
Вы видите абстракцию, а я вижу там тысячи фигур в различных позах.
When you see an abstract drawing on the wall, I see thousands of figures in this seemingly abstract drawing.
И этот рисунок принципиально нельзя закончить. Можно рисовать каждый день еще 10 лет.
It's impossible to finish this drawing in principle. It can be drawn for 10 years without stopping and never be finished.
И вот этой фантазии безграничной пожилого профессора из Тутарепи бросил вызов молодой Даниил Франц, программист.
And when I have this fantasy of middle-aged man, and now I have to face somebody much younger than me who wants to compete with me, you know, with my vision and with what I'm doing in my art.
Ему 16 лет, он молодой, красивый и умный.
He's 16 years old, he is young, he is handsome and intelligent.
Я желаю удачи всем программистам, когда они наконец приблизятся к передаче живого воображения и опыта человеческой жизни.
I wish good luck to all computer people who are trying to catch the life spirit of a draftsman. Perhaps I will reach it someday.
А пока для зрителей это очень интересно. То есть старый рисует, а молодой на машине лепит. И есть результат.
It's a good performative piece because they can compare the styles of different artists from different people. You know, they can actually see it in person, you know, performed in person.
So that's the concept. Now I'm very interested in the technology that's making all this happen. So also here on the technical side is Philip Avatizov. And Philip, you have a computer set up. It is plugged into the 3D printer. We can see even abstract art here on the wall. We can see how the traces are then transferred into the computer. And we can see a screen which shows a sphere with certain indentations, certain distortions. Can you tell me a bit more about what's going on here?
Here is a sensor, which is a part of the projector. When you're taking the point of the screen, you can use it like a mouse. After that, you can see our 3D model modification over there. And after that, I can send the model on the printer, and it will make the model in plastic.
On the screen behind you, we can see what looks like a spinning sphere. And this sphere has kind of distortions within it. Those distortions change then according to how the pencil is traced on the wall, I suppose.
I can start from the very beginning.
And so the artist can manipulate the shape of this sphere in real time as they're drawing.
Yeah, but printing is just after, of course.
Right. So the first stage is to have the sphere on your computer, and then when you're happy with it, you send it to the 3D printer.
Yeah.
Right. How much of a challenge is it to process this on a computer in real time before you 3D print it?
From 10 seconds to 1 minute, I will catch the moment when the figure will become like I like. And after that, I can send it on the printer. But the results, I have to wait maybe 12 hours.
What this does mean is that after that 12-hour printing process, even though the processing is quick and the computer is quick, but the 3D printing takes some time, during which you have effectively converted a two-dimensional array of into a 3D object.
I'm catching several moments, and after that, I can choose what kind of model I would like to pay.
It is quite fascinating because sort of Powell has created a tool for collaboration, which Dylan has used with him in Russia, but now is using with another artist here in Venice. So you could imagine another draftsman drawing on the wall and different things would happen. The three-dimensional objects that are printed are the result of your performance, your creative energy. Then the use of the computer software, but not as a simple machine, not something which just goes through the motions, but something which is itself guided by another artist. So we have a very interesting and I think quite novel form of artistic collaboration. At the moment, it seems to me Ivan is drawing without necessarily an understanding of what the object at the end will be. So it becomes almost like automatic writing. But I suspect and I wonder after a while, using the tool, whether he will be able to guide it and to determine which shapes are most likely. Mm-hmm. And you would actually have something which becomes much more of a targeted process, where you begin to learn which gestures result in which shapes on the sphere, result in which options from three-dimensional objects, and it becomes more like sculpture than automatic writing.
So we heard there from Philip Avatizov and also Ivan Govikov over there in Venice, and of course Bill Thompson was giving us his comments at the end. Well, we're at the end of this program. Other than Philip, I'm Gareth Mitchell, the producer's Colin Grant, and we'll see you again next week. Goodbye for now.